everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Here with episode 179 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Older and Wiser, insight from Money Farm founder Mike Krueger about my conversation with the recently retired grain market advisory guru on May 15th, 2020. Krueger has been part of the agricultural landscape for more than 40 years, but given that he's based in Fargo, North Dakota, I only met him after I started my job here at the Grain Commission. Among other things, Krueger has presented on markets at Farm Forum during Spokane Ag Expo, and he has gone on numerous U.S. Wheat Associates missions overseas, bringing export customers news of U.S. and global grain markets and supplies. I've always liked interviewing people who have retired or are on the cusp of retirement because they tend to be more casual and less careful about what they say. I haven't interviewed Krueger before, so I might be wrong about my assumption, but his candid perspective on the subject of USDA data and its relative merits, not to mention how technology has sidelined human interactions and changed data collection, really set my heart aflutter. If you're a farmer or landlord listening to this episode, I think you'll find it fascinating from the point of view of understanding markets and enhancing an economic return. If commodity markets aren't your thing, then listening to a wise old man with a lifetime working in a rapidly changing industry may just provide some tools for the future. I've always enjoyed learning about people's lives and how they have gotten to the place they find themselves. The result is almost always the story of a journey followed by rooting, blossoming, and harvest.
Well, I grew up in Jamestown, North Dakota, a relatively small town 100 miles west of Fargo, right on Interstate 94. I came to Fargo and went to North Dakota State University, graduated in 1971 with a degree in speech communications education. I did not take an ag course or an ag econ course in my entire college career. Not that I'm proud of that, but that's just how it worked. I was an ROTC person. You know, there was still the tail end of the Vietnam War at the time. So I, after graduation, spent 3 years in the Air Force, most of the time in upstate New York, part of the time on Guam, part of the time in Mississippi and various other places. So I got out of the Air Force in the summer of 1974, which was a horrible time in the job markets. That's when there were wage and price controls and, of course, hundreds of thousands of military exiting the because the Vietnam War had wound way down. But almost kind of by accident, I sent an application to Cargill in Minneapolis because I wanted to get back to the upper Midwest Northern Plains. And they were not looking for any specific degree requirement. Back in the day, Cargill recruited at liberal arts colleges. They rarely hired people with ag econ degrees. So I got an interview with them, went to work for them in September of 1974 in Minneapolis. I moved, I think, five times in the 9 years that I was with Cargill. And in the early 80s, 1982, another fellow who also worked for Cargill, he and I left Cargill, moved back to Fargo to start a little grain marketing company that we called AgriMark. And our intention at the time was to work primarily with independent country grain elevators or cooperative grain elevators to help them with marketing, transportation, and those issues. And as time went on, we gradually transitioned from that into working directly with farmers, which really became almost all of our business.
And when did you establish the Money Farm, and why?
In the late 90s, and I was still with my partner at AgriMark, I started to do a series of radio and TV shows on marketing, just kind of on my own as a sidelight, called The Money Farm. And I had a friend who has an advertising agency in Fargo, who at the time, he and his staff thought up the name The Money Farm and a logo, which I liked a lot. So I used those names for the radio and TV show. And then in 2002, my partner and I separated, went our own separate ways. He kept AgriMark. And I just continued on as the Money Farm. But in addition to doing radio and TV things, I also then, of course, started to work directly with farmers.
It sounds like what you're saying is that most of your education in marketing was sort of on the job. Is that correct?
Pretty much all of it was on the job. Cargill at the time had, you started with them, they had a three-month, what they called a general orientation program, and they had a lot of divisions even then, nothing like, of course, they do now, not nearly as big. But at the end of the 3 months, they would try to match you up with what part of the company they found was a good fit. And back then, I ended up going to work in their country elevator division. And so I worked at a grain elevator in north central North Dakota for a little bit. And then I went to and managed a Cargill-owned grain facility in southwestern North Dakota for 3 years. And came to Fargo and supervised a bunch of their grain elevators in the upper Midwest. And then moved back to Minneapolis where I was in merchandising. But throughout that whole time, it was basically on-the-job training.
All right. So I know you're retired now from the Money Farm, but I'm just sort of curious, how does an outfit like the Money Farm make its money? Is it all from farmers paying you to help them market their crop, or is there some other aspect?
Well, here's how. When we originally started the Money Farm, we started to work with farmers on a fee per acre to help them do their grain marketing. And in addition to that, we published, back when you actually published, and put in the hard copy mail once a week a newsletter. And then, of course, that transitioned into by email. And I'm sure today they're using Twitter and whatever else they can use. And we also marketed that newsletter, almost like a pro-farmer newsletter. We were pretty early in the game separately to farmers. So farmers back then could just subscribe annually to the daily email letter or originally the weekly letter. Or they could pay, I think at the time it was $1 per planted acre, and we'd be on the phone with them frequently talking about what was going on, what we thought they should do, what they should plant. About 5 years, 6 years in, we decided that we should also then become a commodity brokerage operation. And we didn't do that originally because we thought it was a conflict of interest. But what we discovered was that we would tell one of our farmer customers to go hedge some wheat or some corn or some soybeans. So they had to go find a broker. And, 2 months later, they were trading gold and crude oil and who knows it. So we actually did become commodity brokers. And through the years, I suspect that the brokerage end was probably half of our annual income. And then the consulting, the fee breakers, some speaking fees, and the newsletter was the other half. And it just seemed to work out much, much better. We had control of our customers. Almost all of our commodity brokerage customers were also our farm clients. We weren't hustling, speculative accounts. And it worked out very well. And I believe that's still the same model that the Money Farm is using today.
Okay, Mike, I've read reports over the years that if someone marketed their grain straight off their combine, that over time they would receive an average price very similar to those who develop a marketing plan and follow it religiously. I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question for a lot of reasons. One, I've been in this business so long and I've seen all these different cycles come and go. We went to marketing plans, we went away from marketing plans, we went to technical trading, we went away from technical trading, everybody had to worry about the basis and this and that and the other thing. Our feeling forever, and I still think it's true, is that we used to tell our clients that, you really have 18 months to market a crop. 6 months before you plant it, and probably a year after you harvest it, before you harvest the next crop. We also discovered over the years, and I don't think this has changed much, that farmers were motivated to sell when they were forced to sell, either because they were out of space or the grain they had in their space was going out of condition or they were out of money. And typically those three reasons are what, kind of dictated the majority of the grain flows in the market. So I don't think I agree with the fact that if you just did nothing but market when you had to, that you or sold at harvest or whatever particular month that it would work out that way. Things have changed so much over the last 10 or 15 years with all the various crop insurance products out there that's taken, I think, a little bit of the pressure, off of some of the marketing. This year is a classic example. Luckily for producers, the crop revenue assurance minimum prices were established during the month of February, before the virus and all these other things broke loose and markets crashed. So they do have, you know, protection above current levels for part of their crop. So the trick then was, how do you market that 25, 30, 35% of your production, you know, above the insurance guarantees to make sure that you come out all right on that as well. I think the other thing is that, you know, I think especially foreign farmers, farmers from other countries think that U.S. farmers are so sophisticated in marketing that they all use futures and options, and that simply isn't true. Some days I'm not so sure that the percentage of farmers using futures and options markets today is any bigger than it was 30 years ago. And I've consistently said that maybe that's a fourth of farmers who actively will buy put options to put a floor under prices or, you know, actually use futures as a hedge. So I still believe that having a marketing plan and watching markets pays off. I think the other thing, just as a comment about marketing plans, I mean, marketing plans are great, but farmers have to understand those really are living documents. You can't make a marketing plan on February 20th and put it in your desk drawer and then come back on June 1st and say, well, this didn't work. You know, it didn't work for a lot of reasons. Number one, we had the virus that took over 2 weeks later. You might have droughts or floods. So marketing and marketing plans are important, but they only work if you keep an eye on them, update them, talk about them, decide what's changed, and make adjustments accordingly.
All right. Just to get back on your retirement a little bit, I just wonder, what's it like from going into the office every day and poring over data to not doing that anymore? Do you miss it, or are you amazed you did it for so long?
People ask my wife how I like retirement. She says he's not retired. He still does the same thing that he always did. He gets up in the middle of the night, just looks at markets. He talks to people, you know, half the day. He reads things. So yeah, the pressure's off from having to go to the office every day and having to write every day. But I still have a number of customers that have been clients for 15, 20, 30, 40 years that I talk to maybe a couple of times a week just because they want to know what I think. So I keep track of markets. I still write at least a couple of days for the Money Farm that they use. You know, I do write for publications like Wheat Life, Sunflower Magazine. I've tried to stay active on the international circuit with the commodity groups like U.S. Wheat Associates and the Grains Council and others, although, of course, this year that is entirely shut down. I don't think there's a meeting on earth happening. So, it would be really difficult, Scott, for me just to turn the switch off and not follow markets.
That's what all of us who are still working are worried about, what comes next. Do you market any grain of your own?
I do not. Nope. I've never farmed. I have no farmland. I've over the years, you know, I would occasionally dabble with options or futures, but purely from a speculative standpoint and on a very small scale. But no, basically no.
All right. There are grain marketers and farmers out there who I have talked to who believe that the USDA plays hanky-panky with the numbers that go into commodity reports. I mean, some of these people are my friends, and for the life of me, I can't understand what the USDA has to gain by cooking the books. Where do you come down on those who think you can't trust the USDA's numbers?
You know, first of all, I should say that those same expressions have been felt since I started in the grain business back in 1974. I do think that the expressions and the frustrations have grown, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years. My comeback to farmers and others in the industry over the years has always been, hey, I don't believe that they're contriving numbers or trying to make things be what they really aren't. But I have to say, the last several years, I question their numbers and I question their processes. And I'm not so sure that it's a conspiracy or an attempt to kind of skew the markets. I think some things have happened within the USDA over the years that might account for a bit of it. Number one, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years, the old guard is gone. People my age who grew up through the Russian years, the Chernobyl years, the grain embargo years from Carter, everything in between, I mean, who were kind of fundamentally oriented, who talked to people in the industry, who got out in the country occasionally and looked at crops or talked to farmers or whatever, all those people are gone. And I believe, don't have the evidence to prove it or the numbers, but I believe that the USDA has gradually transitioned to more kind of an academic viewpoint, a PhD viewpoint, an economic modeling viewpoint. I know for a fact that they have little contact with the grain industry anymore, and that's kind of a shame, because back in the day, you know, people would communicate. If the USDA had questions on export demand, they would call a Cargill or a Harvest States or a Columbia Grain or whoever. I'm not so sure that there's that level of interaction anymore. I know for a fact that a few years ago, the person who was the head of the World Board at the time, who that's the group who puts out all the supply and demand estimates, had never been in Kansas, never been in a wheat field. And a friend of mine actually got him to come out, took him on a tour. And the next step was to get him up to the Northern Plains and look around, but that just never happened. So I think that's part of what's changed. I think the interpersonal relationships between industry and government have kind of maybe disappeared. I do have some concerns about the last crop reports, and especially the one last Tuesday. And I expressed that in some things that I've said and written.
Yes. In the June 2020 Wheat Life edition, which will be coming out here shortly, you wrote about feeling jaded and that the USDA reports didn't improve your mood. What did you mean?
Well, you know, I, first of all, if you just look at the corn numbers, and we knew that the USDA would use the March planting intentions because that's what they do in the May supply and demand. And we're really talking about the first look at the supply and demand for the 2021 marketing year, the corn and beans and wheat that are just being planted today. So, and they're not based on crop conditions. They're just, you know, however many thousand people in the USDA sit down, look at these numbers. Here's what we think's going to happen. So they used the acreage number on corn of 97 million acres. But then the next step, they used a record yield. You know, forever, people like me, and I think within the USDA, if you start to look at things for crops that haven't even been planted yet, you would maybe go back and use the last three-year average yield or maybe five-year average yield. But to start out of the block saying, yeah, we're going to have a record corn yield this year, it just simply doesn't make sense to me. So that gave us, in their numbers, a 16 billion bushel corn crop. Well, if you look at that, by the time you get to the bottom line, you know, you're going to have a 4 billion bushel corn carryout, which we haven't seen since the early 80s. So I think their next step was, well, hell, we can't have that. You know, we'll be talking about 2.25 corn. So I think they artificially pumped up the export demand on corn by 375 million bushels. They increased the ethanol demand for the next marketing year, even though we can't give ethanol away today. And the result was that instead of a 4 billion ending stocks number, they came out with 3.3. Still big, but it just makes me think, why would they have made those factors? So I think that to get that export number where it is, they're assuming that China's going to come in for a whole lot of corn and a whole lot of ethanol. Now, talk about wheat. They did not factor any of potential China business into the wheat equation. In fact, they are saying today that U.S. wheat exports in the next marketing year will be smaller than they are this marketing year, which doesn't make sense to me. If China's going to comply with the Phase One agreement, they're going to have to buy wheat, they're going to have to buy corn, they're going to have to buy soybeans, pork, you name it, to get to that $30 to $40 billion spending number that was agreed upon. The other thing the USDA did on wheat in this report was, you know, they look at all the world numbers too. So they assigned a record wheat yield to Canada, and Canada has barely started planting their crop. So it's just things like that that I look at and say, you don't need to do that. You don't need to come out of the blocks. You can have a great yield because conditions are good, but why don't you look at Canada today and say, yeah, let's give them a record wheat yield? All that does is bolster world wheat supplies. World traders look at it and say, we don't need to be in a hurry to buy wheat because Canada's going to have a record yield and a record crop. They took Australia from 15 million tons last year to 24 million tons this year. Well, Australia had a significant drought last year. I can see increasing them significantly, but I think that's a little bit excessive. Brazil's corn crop, 60% of which is their second crop corn, and grown in the southern areas of Brazil, planted after the soybean harvest. It's been dry and hot down there for weeks, right in the middle of their pollination season. They raised Brazil's corn crop, 5 million tons. And most analysts are saying at best, it would be unchanged and probably smaller. So it's all those little things like that that I begin to wonder just, really what is happening here. And I'm not the only one that questions that. I've got friends who have been in the business even, believe it or not, longer than I have, who will say, I don't get their rationale or their thinking in some of these things. So, and I think that's what farmers look at, and that's why farmers get frustrated. And it's not just the World Board that puts out supply and demand estimates. It's the NAS, National Ag Statistics Service, that puts out acreage numbers, yield numbers, production numbers. So I do think there's become somewhat of a disconnect. I don't know that we'll ever see it corrected. And having said all of that, I think people have to understand that worldwide there isn't a match for at least the volume of numbers that the USDA puts out. The reliability of them might be a slightly different question.
I'm listening to your answer to that question, and it seems to me like you're basing your answer on a lot of experiential thing, wisdom that you have gained over the years. My question is, how much of your advice is based on the numbers, and how much is based on your gut?
Good question. And I guess I'd have to say maybe 50-50, 50% on the numbers, 50 on my gut feeling. And those have seriously changed over the years. I think a lot of things have happened as we've gotten into this electronic world or cyber world or the new world of Zoom. Back before that, we actually talked to people. We had friends in Kansas. We had grain industry people in Minneapolis or Portland or wherever that we would pick up the telephone and talk to about what do you see happening out there? How's your crop look? Call a producer in Washington State or whatever. What do you think of the USDA's numbers? Are there things going on in the background with transportation or other issues that we should know about that might affect this whole thing? I don't think much of that happens anymore. I know that I watch some much younger people than I am in the industry today, a couple of whom I know really well, and it took me years to – they would come into my office and say, hey, so-and-so just did this. I said, well, how do you know that? They say, well, because it was posted on Twitter. Well, do you have any idea who posted it on Twitter? Do you know anything about the person's background, experience, level of knowledge? It could be me in my basement overnight just putting out false stuff on Twitter or whatever website it might be. So I think people, it's kind of like, sort of in a way like I feel about the general news media. They've lost that investigative skill to really go to the source and find out what's going on. Don't rely on an anonymous tweet from somebody that you've never heard of. The other thing that's changed in these markets is that I think 20 years ago, 15 years ago, fundamentals did play a much bigger role in how these futures markets traded. Market composition has changed dramatically. We've gone to totally electronic trading. Funds dominate in terms of volume. They're technically oriented. The grain exchanges have all catered the rules, regulations, trading limits, trading hours, you name it, to cater to the funds, not to the industry, because the funds are where the volume comes from. That's who pays their bill. So I think that has basically changed the tenor and tone of the markets. And I'm smart enough to know that we still can't have open outcry markets that just couldn't handle the volume anymore. But we really lost kind of a sense or a feel of the psychology of the markets when that all went away, because people on the floor had a sense of what was happening and why and who was doing what, why they were doing it. So today I read market commentary today that says funds sold 5,000 contracts of wheat, and I haven't gotten an answer yet, but who really knows that, right? Because it's all electronic. I can sit here in my living room on my little laptop and trade millions of bushels in volume electronically. Nobody has any idea who I am or what I'm doing. So I just wonder sometimes if some of the stuff we read about what's pushing markets back and forth isn't simply created in cyberspace because no one really knows.
Because no one really knows. Well, that's not confidence inspiring when it comes to market information, is it? If you liked Kruger's clear-headed analysis and want to hear more of the same, be sure to listen to the second half of my conversation in episode 180, or what I entitled, Older and Wiser, Insight from Money Farm Founder Mike Kruger 2, next week. That's when he'll answer my question asking what he would change about today's commodity market if he had the power to do so. Speaking of which, what would you change? Keep that thought in mind and then join me here again next week for the second half of my conversation with wheat, corn, and soybean marketing guru Mike Kruger right here on Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.